running boom of the 70s came during simpler, pre-internet times. A unique cast of characters riding that wave came of age. You never knew who would show up, and races became household names, attracting capacity fields year in and year out. Co-hosts Ron Galluli, John Gorman, and Grant Whitney, inspired by the first Runners Reunion in 2019, speak with some of the characters of the era, share their stories, and where they are today. There's something for everyone in each installment of the Runners Reunion Podcast.
Good afternoon, Runners Reunion listeners. We're back for another episode here in Season 3. Our guest this evening is cut from a different cloth. A self-described non-traditional entry, a late bloomer, if you will. A proud 1973 graduate of Swampscott High School. Moved on to PC, Providence College, a theme of Season 3. But despite rubbing shoulders with the likes of John Tracy, Mick O'Shea, and Mick Byrne, running never sunk in. Moving on soon thereafter from PC, he again took the non-traditional path, started teaching on a volunteer basis, and as he started coaching kids, girls and boys, suddenly found himself enamored of the sport and became a student of the sport. That's quite a segue to becoming a 1349 5K performer, 2818 10K performer, 4407 15K, and the list goes on. He's made several USAA teams, USAA teams, including USA, USSR, where he got to rub shoulders with our friend Bob Hodge. He actually ran a USA East Germany meet in the LA Coliseum the year before the Olympics. Suffice it to say, we suspect we're going to have some fun anecdotes and some interesting stories as we entertain a conversation with Paul Gorman. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on the Runners Reunion Podcast.
Thanks, Grant. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, hopefully you'll still feel that way at the end. These are your words, by the way, late bloomer, non-traditional. You got to tell us a little bit about that. Give us, because this is not, you know, I would say on average, gentlemen, most of our guests have kind of followed the more traditional arc. So this is a little different, and I think our listeners are going to enjoy this.
Yeah, I always wanted to be an athlete, whether it was baseball or basketball, and jumped in both feet until I was told, yeah, you're not going to make the team. And then moved on to the next sport. And that's how running started for me and then stopped trying.
Yeah, well, I was about to say, I think there's a story in there somewhere about a 300-pound first baseman. And how did that, hopefully you didn't suffer too much physical injury in that situation.
No, in the tryouts for the varsity baseball team, one was run the base pass, the whole three bases to home, and you got timed. And I had one of the fastest times. And so, all right, maybe we'll keep this guy around. I could pitch batting practice too. But where they put me in, we had a first baseman that was, you know, 6'3", 300 pounds. They could hit the ball a mile. We didn't have a fence. It could go all the way down to the basketball court near the street, but he could only basically make the second base. So I got the call, and that was pretty much my baseball career and the start of my running career.
Okay.
Unbeknownst to me.
Well, how did that transition happen then? So for the record, the 300-pound first baseman didn't do any harm, didn't hurt you in any way.
Right.
Okay.
So, and that was, you know, towards the end of my spring junior year. And so going into my senior year, with a bunch of guys, we'd practice basketball down the park, getting ready for the season, and thought I needed to get in better shape and approach the coach. One of the coaches was a chemistry teacher and was my chemistry teacher. And with 2 weeks left in the season, 2 weeks before basketball tryouts, I asked him if I could, you know, run with the team. And he said, no, it's too late. And, you know, but I had friends there. So kind of convinced them to let me run. So I ran with them a couple of days, and another day later, their track meet, their final dual meet up in Newburyport, which they'd run before. And I was able to hop into the junior varsity meet. And so I just followed. They knew where they were going. I had to follow them the whole time. And it was on the streets. The cross country meet there was on the streets. And as we approached, we ended up on the track. So once I saw the track, I took off and I won the junior varsity meet. And if I ran the varsity meet, I think I might have been fifth man and we would have won on points on the varsity. Newburyport had a great varsity runner.
Yeah, Buddy so Boston. That was, oh, I'm sorry. So that was your real first glimmer of something.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, because I finally did the math. I'm a little slow on the uptick here. Yep. So this is the fall of 72 entering into the winter of 73. So correct. Munich happened not that much earlier in the year. Do you have any memories of running and of any of that? Or was that just not?
Just watching the Olympics as, anybody else would watch all the different sports. And I think probably a couple of the track races in the marathon, if I can remember. The 800.
Dave Waddle, of course.
Right, that was famous.
That's famous, yeah.
With his hat coming around.
But and nothing that kind of inspired you out of that moment or anything. So it was like it happened, but nothing that resonated. So, okay. So then pick up the tale. So you suddenly had this glimmer. Basketball, you got a winter coming up. No indoor track, presumably, or anything like that.
No. It was tried out for the basketball team, made the team, but the coach, who was a neighbor down the street, actually, his son is Mike Lynch, was the sportscaster, Mike Lynch, who I still see once in a while. I still see Mike once in a while. But his dad just sat me down and said, Paul, you're not going to play. You may, might keep you on the team, but you're not going to play. I talked to the indoor track coach. He wants you there. So I ended up running, did the 600 and the 1,000, and I did all right.
But this is a senior. This is as a senior. This is your first exposure to it all.
Right. So I went through the season. I jumped in, did the high jump, the traditional, not the flop. The flop was not quite there yet. So I was going traditional.
Straddle. Oh, yeah.
The straddle. How you practice a straddle in 1972, 73 is they put out the blue mats, the little thin blue mats, and set up the high jump standard. And you jump over and land on these little thin mats on the gym floor. So I didn't get very high. I think I got 5.4 maybe. But I was able to get a few points. I got some points running and then that spilled over into spring track.
Okay.
And he kind of shifted me down into the half mile, which, 2.04, not terrible, but not qualified for states or anything. And where that cross country race, some long distance, but I never ran the mile or 2 mile. But that was it. And I had one wonderful race that summer. A friend of mine dragged me to the, at that time, Massachusetts Junior AAU meet. I forget where it was. I think it was down in Falmouth or something.
All right.
And ran the 880 at that time there. And I was in the middle of the pack. I wasn't in great shape. And we were sitting down watching the rest of the races, and they had the 1 mile walk.
The race walk.
And they only had one person in it. So a couple of us jumped in, said, can we register? We registered. And I came in third out of three, but found out the two people in front of me got disqualified for running. So I became the Mass Junior AAU 1 mile walk champ.
Paul, just for the record, that does not show up on your world athletics profile. But okay.
I don't know why that isn't posted somewhere.
Well, okay. So, you're having fun is what I'm going to gather from that. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. And again, the beginning of my social network were around runners, different runners, even though if I didn't really get into running, that's who I hung around with. Again, didn't spur me to do any running at that time, but it was around me.
So you graduate from Swampscott, 73. Do you remember much about your college search? Obviously, you weren't a recruited athlete because you weren't.
Nope. I think I applied to a handful of colleges and ended up down in Providence College, and felt like maybe it's time to really think about running a little bit more, and walked into the coach and said, you know, I'd love to be able to run with the team, maybe join the team. And he said, okay, but really didn't help or coach me. And that was the beginning of the Irish network of runners. Okay. Mick O'Shea was the first of the runners. There was another guy there that year, Campbell. I forget his...
John Campbell?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I think he was there.
I think he's still in the area. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So I got to be friends with Mick O'Shea, and we'd hang around a bit. And I ran through that fall into the first couple of indoor track meets. And I remember one indoor track meet. Again, I was way back, but I could hear the leader through the whole thing, because I can't remember his name, but he was from Springfield, and he ran, and we were at Tufts. You know, you ran through the tunnel at that time, and he always ran with keys, and you could hear him jingle. It was the 2 mile indoors. And so I couldn't see him, but I could hear him through that. And then after that, I stopped running, finished my senior year. I mean, finished my freshman year, went back for my sophomore year. I lived off of campus, and where I roomed with another runner who was then a senior. O'Connor was his name. I can't remember his first name. He became a lawyer. And Mick Byrne was my roommate.
So how did that happen? I mean, off campus, and
just from being friends and staying friends with the cross country team, you know, because at that time, Providence was pretty much just distance runners. There wasn't really any track runners. I think they went down to maybe a half mile. You know, it was really interesting. By my sophomore year, the year before I got there, they won the New England championships with all these guys from upstate New York. And then the next year or the year after, when all the Irish guys came, those guys were relegated to the junior varsity, and all the Irish guys won the New England's. And these guys who had won it a year or two before didn't even make the team. So real transition and started that whole Irish connection.
And for our listeners, I'll just interject here for a minute. Mick Byrne is on to have a very distinguished career as a collegiate coach, and is currently had been at Iona, and is ripping things up, or his team is ripping things up at Wisconsin now. Is that
right?
So you haven't been that far removed, Paul, is what it sounds like from the sport. So as you in our pre-record here, our pre-brief, it sounds like maybe PC wasn't the best fit for you, and you decided to chart again, go in a slightly different direction, a non-traditional direction. Tell us a little bit about that, because that sounds like it really played an important role in the next steps, in the next chapter.
So I decided, well, I'm just going to take some courses that interest me. And I think for people who live around us may know, at Harvard, they have a Harvard Extension, which are night courses that anybody can take. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to get in and take the courses. But since it was just open, I got in there. So I would take some night classes. One was around education, and they wanted us to volunteer in the school system. So I did in my local school system that I knew, and ended up working in the resource room, which was focused on special education, just as a student teacher, paraprofessional at that time. And again, some of my social network were runners. And I knew the women's coach. She was from Marblehead. And I asked if she needed some help, I'd volunteer. And so I just started volunteering, coaching, you know, it's just to help her, you know, again, starting to be a student of the sport. So I got to learn a little bit more. And I'd go out running with the girls just to, you know, help them along. And then the next year continued. I got hired as a paraprofessional at the school while I was going to school nights. And then I moved over to the boys team. Freddie Doyle, who, you know, was a very good runner during that time, too. And he introduced me to a lot of people. And so I coached with him. And the assistant coach was this gentleman, Bill Adams, who played for the Buffalo Bills. And he was the weight course coach. He was a big, big boy. And
so John, I see you've got a question for the other Gordon.
I couldn't help but mention that today is Fred Doyle's birthday.
Oh, that's right.
Happy birthday to Fred Doyle. Just want to mention that.
That's it. He is the leap year baby. That's exactly right.
Now, Paul, just to set the record straight, you realize that you basically, you know, went back to Massachusetts in your early 20s and basically broke the flow that are so critical to John Gorman's development and Ron Galluli's development. I just want to, gentlemen, this is your opportunity to question Paul as to whether or not he made a rash decision to go back home. Or should he have stuck it out and or gone to URI or gone to RIC or something like that? So, gentlemen, this is your opportunity.
I should have went to Johnson and Wales. That's where I should have gone.
Okay,
where all the runners were.
Okay. But Paul made a point earlier that he rested his legs, and that may have helped him when he made his upward times or down times.
So you're okay.
You know,
so
That's a good point, because, you know, in this country, when you run track in high school, college, they double and triple you wherever they can for all these meets. And so many kids get burnt out after even high school, if not college.
So how did that reality, Paul, as you are now picking up the boys and the girls as a paraprofessional teacher and doing all that? Was that in your mindset as a coach or?
Yeah, well, it wasn't at that time, because if you can remember, in that 76, 77, you were talking about long, slow distance. It was all distance, 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 not super hard distance, good workouts in between. And so everyone got their distance runners to run probably more miles than the previous generation of distance runners, just because that was the general sense. And both in the girls, because Freddie, when he was coaching the boys, and then he also coached the girls, I think, across country, he got them running, and he produced some really strong, strong runners.
Okay.
Overworking them hard workouts, but just that distance, building that endurance.
That foundation, yeah.
So he really pumped out a lot of kids that used that going into college.
So how did that work for you? You're taking courses at night.
Yep.
Following your muse, if you will, you know, taking stuff that was interesting to you, and you're getting this. But how did it really begin to shape your running? I'm curious about that.
It wasn't my diet, because when I got through coaching, I had the 65 Volkswagen Bug standard, and I would drive into Cambridge three nights a week. I'd stop at McDonald's, have my Big Mac and fries and drink while I'm driving a stick shift in, and then stop in Somerville at Harold's Ice Cream. I get a hot fudge sundae and sit in the back of the class and eat that every night. So,
okay. Well, that we count it that
wasn't,
off. Yeah. That
was it wasn't diet related. It was, again, folks that I hung around with. Swampscott always pumped out a few good high school runners. Some of them went through college. I ended up running with them in my morning runs, WF Newhall. And then I got to a point in my running, all of a sudden I started to get into races a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And all these guys that were around that we knew, we started a track club, Coastal Track Club, at that time.
Okay. So this is in the early to mid 70s, is that kind of?
Yep, now getting closer to 78,
okay.
79. And we produced a few road races. Back then is when, like, the Miller Lite series, and they would you got all the beer companies to sponsor the races that we would put on, and so the money we would raise, we used that to travel to races around, and we got some really good runners. We worked a little bit with Norm Levine. We'd work out with him out in Waltham, and Dom Finelli, and Buddy Bostic was on Coastal. John Forster, you know, we got a lot of the good local college kids and to run together as a team and go to all these races and meets around. So again, it just rubbed off on me, and having this probably addictive personality, good thing I didn't drink. That's where the running addiction just started. And
yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, not to break too much of a flow here, but East Coastal. So was this track and cross country and roads? Was it everything or what was it? Was? Okay.
It was everything. So we would go to track meets. I remember one summer we went up and ran against a Montreal track club, And we did it in the on the practice track outside their the Olympic Stadium. Up there. So we all, Paul, oh boy. Paul,
okay, yeah.
Good
yeah.
job. Good job. And so we took the trip up there, and but we had a lot of great times just getting in cars and going to all these meets around. It was an activity, and it was fun. It was competition. And then all of a sudden it turned into a little bit more serious, where really looking at training techniques, speed workouts for longer distance.
So you became a student, you were saying, in our prep. How would you describe that curiosity developing, and how did it now become a little bit more focused, it sounds
just,
like?
Just because I'm looking at what the best runners did. You know, when you looked at some of the running magazines at that time, the newer running magazines come out, they always interviewed runners and they talk about their track workouts or run, you know, their training routines. Little be known to me, I thought that's what they did all the time. They usually just probably told them their best weeks that they've ever done. I'm trying to repeat it every week and couldn't keep up with it. But now, as I looked, you kind of fell into, like a lot of us did, the training theories and thoughts of Bill Squires and Bob mm-hmm. Semeny at that time was mm-hmm. there, Sev, mm-hmm. running. That kind of longer interval workouts with shorter rests. And so that's what stuck with me. And
so it kind of a little derivative of that. Was there something in the air or the water where you were that was significant? In other words, you're in Massachusetts. Are you aware of what's happening in Chicago, West Coast, or anything like that? Or are you kind of more parochial? Are you just kind of in the ethos of New England, if we want to go that far?
You would think, okay, that's kind of, it could be almost small-minded if you just think you're your local region. But we were in a hotbed. This was one of the meccas of running, that, and out and up in the Northwest and maybe Colorado. You know, Gainesville area before us, kind of. And
so were you aware of it at the time? I mean, do you remember that kind of sense of this is happening and this is really where it's happening?
Yeah, because then as I started to follow it, now you're following all the races and it just that connection. People introduce you to people in the shoe companies that were runners too. And at that time, if you did anything in running, they're giving shoes away. They're trying to really grow their brand everywhere. And for me, making the breakthrough, I was a real beneficiary of being at the right place at the right time to get a contract and to run. Would it be the same now? I don't know. But at that time, with the growth, they were looking for larger groups of people, not just the tip of the tip, but a real broad base of folks to...
The good-looking Gorman has a question. So,
you know, I'm not just all about looks. I like to think that, I'm a little cerebral too. But so was the Coastal Track Club sponsored by New Balance at one time?
Nope.
It wasn't?
Nope.
Why did I think it was?
They did. After I left to go to New Balance,
They did.
They sponsored the clothing and some shoes. And I even think they gave some travel money too. I think you're right.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah, I remember
the NB on it.
Yeah. I didn't know if that had any effect on you being sponsored by them later on, when you got really good.
It could have. I can't remember. Like I said, we had a good group of people that were always up in the local races in the top few. So we were able to gain a name for ourselves.
So you mentioned, I think a couple of times now, the notion of breakthrough. So if I ask that directly, what do you see as your breakthrough? How would you respond?
So I think there was two pieces to it. Mm-hmm. One, I wanted to get serious, and everything that I read, I think I read a book on Steve Prefontaine. Again, his workouts were crazy, and trying to duplicate that and the magic 100-mile weeks. And I always kept on breaking down because I think I was running too hard too many days. I just couldn't keep it up. But I would break through in a race that, run low 14s for 5K, which wasn't too bad. Or
on the track or on the roads?
On the track. and you know, running right around 5 minutes mile, 31 minutes on the roads for 10K, which was good locally. You could be competitive. And then was really frustrated, always getting hurt, mostly my calves and towards my Achilles. And I went to, it's so interesting now when you look at what's available for athletes now for around medical, nutrition, everything. You know, back then, if you went to a doctor, they didn't know how to really treat someone that's running 100 miles a week, what's normal, what's not normal. And so you had to find your own folks. And I found two people at that time. One was a massage therapist over at the Salem Y, Bill Maher.
Jack Maher.
Yeah. And he's got a few books out. And he would work on horses in the morning and humans in the afternoon.
Oh, okay. I got to interrupt here. Have all four of you ever been treated by, so we know yes. Paul has.
Ron, I've been to see Jack Maher. Fitzy was a big fan of Jack Maher and spent a lot of time there.
I saw him once. So the four of us, we have a common theme right there. Okay.
As you remember, he was a big man.
He was a big man. Big thumbs too. Like, big hands.
And he could make you sweat and almost cry on the table.
So he was affiliated with the Y. They actually let him into the Y?
Yeah. So way back in the Y, back then, they had two different tiers of locker rooms, one for the businessmen that had the massage and kind of TV, and they'd hang out. And Jack, kind of that old-time massage therapist, he had the, I don't know, it was kind of like an alcohol rub that he would put on you to rub. And he always had a bottle of whiskey in his locker and, you know, have great stories. But, you know, he worked on world-class horses. He went around the world with those, although he didn't like to fly. And he had a number of books out. And so, yeah, really interesting character. So went to him. And the other person I went to was a chiropractor, but had a professional sports background in baseball. And I told him about my legs. And he watched me run. And he noticed that I bounced. Some very good runners are toe runners. Yeah. But being a bigger 6'1", 155, took a little bit of stress. And I learned to roll off my toes. And it didn't take me long to adapt. And all of a sudden, the same amount of effort, I was able to run more miles. And that was like, say, September of 81. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I was starting to build up the miles now to 100, 120 miles towards the end of 81 to just about 140 miles a week, and running decent workouts and some races that had glimpses of it. Starting to go under 5 minutes a mile for 10K. I ran the BC relays in December, right around Christmas time. And it was a 3K there, 3,000 meters. I won on a kick. I beat this guy, Tony Colon, from Puerto Rico at that time. And it was like, whoa, that was something unusual, you know, a couple of weeks before my real breakout run. So there was a buildup of confidence, I guess that did it. Confidence that I could run longer now, I could run harder. And then with some of the races that I ran, built up the confidence that I could stay with more people.
So before we get to the breakthrough, because you're teasing us really well with this, Paul, I must say. Guys, do you have any questions? There's a theme here that I'd love to, I'm curious about. John, Ron, anything you want to jump in on?
Well, just one comment on that. BC Relays indoor track. It was a terrible track. So I don't know what time you ran, but I'm sure if you could convert that onto BU's track today, it'd be a really fast time.
Yeah. That was a really tight, tight, flat track.
I'm curious. Yeah, go, John.
So, just going back to Coastal, and you said that you generated money through road races like the Miller Lite Series. Is that the one that they had up in Newburyport? The 5K, there's a picture that used to be in Rick Baco's Yankee Runner magazine. I mean, Yankee Runner store, and you're in the picture. Bruce Bickford, Paul Hammond's there, but he's kind of in the back of it. Who's who of running, and that was unbelievable.
You know what that series was? It was the radio station up there. I forget the name of the radio station. They had they had a little series up there. Mm-hmm. And that race with Bruce, I remember, I think Randy Thomas ran that race. There were a couple others. Yeah. I mean,
like it was Wallen, a big, Tommy. Wallen, yeah, Collins, there was, Tommy Rath.
It was a big race. And I remember we were coming down to the last. I took off at like more than a mile out. And Bruce was the only one that went with me. And I thought it'd be my chance to beat Bruce because a couple of days earlier, he had just come back from Europe. He beat Alberto Cova a couple of days before in a race. So I thought he would be tired. And it came down to a kick, and he outkicked me right at the end.
Wow.
But he was at the top of his game. Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember that.
I'm struck by the willingness on your part to totally change the way you ran.
Yeah, it was dramatic.
And you know, how did you mentally tell yourself on a regular basis until it became muscle memory, I suppose?
Yeah.
How did you say no bounce roll? I mean, how can you give us just a little insight as to what went in your mind? I just find that fascinating.
It was really what probably helped as well. It was like a total relaxation of my legs. Where when you're a toe runner, it's almost a little bit tenser, if I can remember. And the roll was just more relaxing. Now, if anybody was running near me, they knew it was me because I slapped. My feet slapped the whole time. You could just hear it slap. So it wasn't like a smooth roll. It was like a slap roll right off of that. But but very loud and annoying.
but that was the way you ended up training through the bulk of your career then.
Yeah. And it was able to run, 140 miles a week for a year on.
Even with slapping. So not bouncing. You went from bouncing to slapping. Okay, yeah, there we go. So you've teased this up and we've kept our listeners in suspense. What was the breakthrough, Paul, if you walk us through it?
At this point, you're looking at races to go to. And I saw it was the New Year's Eve race down in New York City. So it begins at midnight. And I had run earlier in the fall trying to keep up in a race with Randy Thomas and Greg Meyer for as long as I could. And it only worked for about two and a half miles in a 10K. And I ended up fourth. I think Tim Donovan beat me on that. He was third on that one. So going into this race, so Greg Meyer was there and said, he's the person. I said in my head, I'm going to stay with him as long as I could. And for whatever reason, I was able to do it. All the confidence, all the lead up, all the miles paid off. And we ran, it was 5 miles, ran 23:01. He ran 23 flat and he beat me by a step. And he had just signed with Brooks at that time. And they did a big promotional poster of him cross with his arms out and Brooks across, and you can see my hand in the picture. Of course, all my buddies back home when I came up, they got a poster and they all signed it, saying things about my hand. Hey, great hand. It's great that too bad your body can be as good of a runner as your hand or something, just harass me. But, and then after that, there was a party at the New York Road Runners Club and a couple of shoe company started to talk to me. And then I ran a couple weeks later, 5K indoors at BU, which was a super fast track in the old armory. So it was dark.
The old U.S. armory, kind of armory.
Yeah,
kind of
but stuff, with a new track, really steep banks. And I think I came in second or third. I think Bruce Bickford won it. The time was 13:35, but we found out a few days later that the track is measured a little short. So they gave me a time like 6 seconds slower, like 13:41 or 42.
But that's a debut 5K, really?
Yeah.
So wow.
And so that's when Bruce had just signed with New Balance not too early before that. And Kevin Ryan approached me about, running for New Balance. They were building the team. I think Haji was already on the team. I think John Tracy was already on the team. So there were a bunch of folks on the team that were local that I knew. Kevin Ryan was a really big supporter, mentor of mine. You know, he's just he really encouraged me. Here is someone that, you know, was an Olympian from New Zealand, and he was one of those crazy, crazy runners. He made the Olympics while working full time. I think he worked full time for like the electric company down there, and had a family early on. And he was putting in these crazy miles with Arthur Lydiard. And then he came to this country, and he was perfect for that time for a lot of us. He was really encouraging. He understood the miles that you put in. And although he did make fun of us because none of us really worked anymore.
So he had one on you.
We didn't have real jobs. Did. He really worked.
He was working full time when he was here too. Yeah.
John.
Funny story. So I remember when I was working at New Balance when you were sponsored by him, and I remember one day you came in the office to talk to Kevin, whatever. And so I said, So Paul, you just run. What do you do all day? And you're kind of like, I don't know. I go for a run around 11 o'clock, come back. I just watch MTV all afternoon. You know, and MTV was really big back then, of course.
It was.
Said, come on. Yeah. And I just watch MTV, you know, have a few hours and go back, go out for my second run. I still remember that to this day. It was
like, and you were probably saying, what a loser. How did you get a contract?
Well, lucky guy. But you're right, though. Now, I'm not sure if, when you go to retirement, if MTV is still on. there must be something you can watch. It can use up your afternoon.
Well, quick story. You know, most of the time I ran by myself here, but we had a big morning group of runners. So run 10 miles in the morning, and we'd start at my house. Funny that you said MTV. There was two things that MTV just started, and there was this thing called the 20-minute workout. And it was always with a very nice young woman in tights and workout. So we happened to watch that before we go for our runs every day. Everybody'd be around the TV in my apartment, and then we'd go out for a run.
Oh, boy. Yep. Well, we got to watch that one. That's a little bit close to the line, gentlemen. But but having said that, so now you've arrived. Is this the window when, and I'm guessing maybe this is on the track, and now you're rubbing shoulders with guys who had been names, but now are, in some cases, teammates. As you look back to those critical years, you're now a New Balance athlete, you're a sponsored athlete, making some money, or at least holding your own.
Yep.
Do you see yourself as a cross-country runner, a track runner, or a road runner? And you got to pick one. What is it?
Yeah, it's got to be a track runner, a 10K, which is insane when you think about it, to really like that. You know, when you get in a groove on the track, there's so many, I think there's so much more strategy that happens. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I found going from, you know, a decent local regional runner to national, international competitions, whether it's on the roads or on the track, especially 10K, 5 miles of 10K. When you're on the local regional, by the time you get to 2 miles, there are three or four guys with you. When you go to the national, internationals, everybody's still there. And then in the local races, you're hanging on until the last half mile, quarter mile to kick. In the national, international, at about 3 miles, when everybody's hurting, all of a sudden moves are made. Like, oh my God, I'm dying. Where are these people going? And that's where the breaks were made, you know, at that time, because everybody's hurting. So if you could plow through that and hang on, you're going to have a good race.
So you're talking much more of the mental side of it at this point.
Yeah.
That's what seems to be the differentiator.
Yeah.
So if we looked at some of those international races, and we mentioned you were USA, USSR, with Bobby Hodge on that, you've had all of that. Are there some experiences there that really crystallize that idea for you?
Yeah. So right after, you know, I signed with New Balance, ran the race at BU, qualified me for the national 3 mile on a 10
indoor
Square Garden. I didn't run as well as I hoped, came back, and 2 days later, I ran the 10 miles up in Amherst, a 10-mile race, and tied for first, you know, just to get that out of me. But after that, things really went boom, boom, boom. I ran the Penn Relays. That was my Penn Relay. And when you think of Penn Relays, you think of a packed stadium, people yelling and screaming. Well, the distance race is on Thursday night, and there's 33 people in the stands that, and three might know you and yell your name. That was a race that there was Danny Dillon, the three Athletics West guys that I ran with. And I made the decision that at 3 miles, I was going to take off. And I took off, and every lap they tried to catch, I took off again, took off, and they just outkicked me. It was like boom, boom, boom. It was really tight finish for all those guys. Again, a lot of confidence there, great time. And then I ran the New Jersey 10 miler not too long after that. And
that, now that's on the roads, though.
On the roads. Yeah. And that was kind of more of a major road race in the country. And that was one that, again, at about 8 miles, I took off. I only one or two guys went with me, and I outkicked them at the end, won that, and then go to the Nationals, which I think were down in Knoxville, Tennessee at that time. And I think I was like seventh or eighth in the 10K there. And that, I think that might have qualified me for the Russian, the USS Army. But why I say the track, so from 82, 83, 84, which was a funky year for me, but 85, 86, and 87, I never finished worse than eighth in the 10K in the national 10 on the track.
Oh, in the Nationals, okay. Mm-hmm.
So my best one, I think, was in 83, which was the World Championship Trials, and they were out in Indianapolis. I came in seventh, and they take the top three, you know, for the the World Championships. And I was 20 seconds off of third place, or 40 seconds. It was pretty close. I had a great race. Okay, next year's the Olympic trials, so of course I'm going to put in more miles, going to work harder. And I got hurt, and I just didn't rebound from that. I got so possessed on how people were running so fast and could keep a peak for so long. At one point during that time, in the, this was 83, maybe into the 84, one week I ran 167 miles. You know, I figured I got to run more miles and be.
Okay. So help me there, because you are describing mileage that I more associate with a roadie, 10K, right. 15K and up. But yeah. You're saying you want to focus on the track. So
right.
Give us a very brief snippet, if you would, of what enabled you with that mileage to run fast, because you've already said you were like you weren't exactly busting the miles there,
right?
At 140.
Right. So what I felt is running that mileage, 140 miles, gave me the endurance.
Okay.
To foundation. Run faster, mm-hmm. even though when you're running 10K against international people, those guys can run four flat. I was not a four flat miler. So trying to do it on the endurance side as opposed to the real quickness side. So I wasn't able to run hard track workouts. I could do really once a week a good track workout, maybe a second one, not as hard. My other hard workout was the 20 miler, you know, to run the 20 miles.
Could you give me a sense? I'm very curious about this, obviously, as you can tell. If you did a track workout, would they be longer intervals and volume, or what would they be like?
Yeah. So, you know, my go-to were two workouts, depending on what was coming up. If there wasn't a race in the next week or so, 2 weeks, I'd run three times a mile with a quarter mile jog rest in between. Okay. Usually right at just a hair slower than my 10K pace. Okay. So it was just to get the heart rate up, short rest, and jump right in. And then the week that I had a race, I do six halves with a 220 rest, pretty much right at race pace. Okay. I never did anything faster than race pace.
No, Andrew. Okay.
So it was the shorter rest.
Was any of your concern doing such high mileage, weight control at all? Because you would mention that you were 6'1", 150 pounds, and you said, you know, I was a little heavy. Did that ever enter it? Like, okay, I got to keep my weight down. You had that diet, you know, the McDonald's diet. And
yeah, I had I wish I had a dietitian, you know, what I know now, you know, back then, because I ate horrible. I finished my run. I'd go down to this little Super 8, Cindy Super 8, get a sub, chips and a soda with cupcakes. That's pretty much my lunch every day. At night, pasta, pizza. If we had a workout somewhere with a guys up here, if I run with these guys, our thing was to go to a pizza place and see who could eat the whole pizza. Terrible, terrible diet. I don't know how I got. It was interesting. Once I stopped running, my contract with New Balance ended in 88. And I went to work for a Jewish community center up here in Marble, which is like a YMCA. One of the people there that belonged there was a gentleman that you probably know, Barry Sears, who the Zone Diet.
Oh, yeah.
Then. So he convinced me to get back into competitive running and follow the Zone Diet, which is the same, you know, diet of more protein, less carbs, you know, and I wasn't into it at that time. But over the past, you know, number of years, I followed that more when I wanted to lose weight and I felt better. I wish I'd listened to him back then. Yeah, my diet was horrible. I'm sure I could have run better, but I never had a problem. I never had a problem with my weight unless I got hurt and took a couple weeks off, because then I'd get bloated because I wouldn't change my diet. I'd still eat lousy stuff for so, which was terrible. You know, looking back, like, you know, just a knucklehead.
Yeah, I mean, running was a great tool to lose weight back then. It isn't anymore at our age,
right?
But
right.
You just don't. It's all about portions now.
So. So you talk about diet, and you also talk about Miller Lite as being the sponsors from those days. And we've had plenty of guests on the podcast that talk about the social element, probably more on the roads than on the track, and the you know, and the beer flowing after the race. You know, you get talk about Litchfield. You do all that. You know, those things. But were you a teetotaler? Was that the sense you kind of gave us?
I was never a big drinker, you know. Mm-hmm. But you go to these races, but for whatever reason, I was just never a big drinker. One or two beers, and that's it.
Enough.
I hung around with a lot of guys that were endurance drinkers, but endurance drinkers.
That's a new term. That's one we've not heard before. Okay, I kind of like that one. You know, you've mentioned a great number of names, which is going to be a huge asset for John in running the show here. Bobby Hodge has come up on a couple of occasions. Also in the prep meeting, you had an anecdote or two about one of our other guests, Pete Fitzinger. Would you be willing to share that one?
Yeah, so it obviously knew Pete from running and running for New Balance. And I believe he lived up in Magnolia for a while up that way. Our 20 milers, the guys I used to run with around here, local runners, we would start in my house in Swampscott and run through Swampscott, through Salem, get over to Route 127 in Beverly and run 127 all the way up to Gloucester. And once we get to Gloucester, our prize was this soda called Twin Lights, which is the only place it was sold. And it had real sugar in it. And then we would take the train back so you had to time it. So you run 20 miles, you're salty and sweaty, you're cold. So you didn't want to wait for the train too long. Those poor people who sat next to us on the train is a different story. But so this one time I'm running, WF Newhall and I are doing our long run. And at that time, Salem had a drawbridge. They didn't have the bridge that they have now. And the drawbridge went up. So we're just 5 miles into it. And the drawbridge went up. So we had to wait. And we're looking at the time and said, we got to really book it. So the next 15 miles, we were really flying. I mean, we were running 6 minutes better all the way for the next 15 miles. And we're getting up there close to Magnolia. And here comes Pete Fitzinger jogging down towards us. And we just said, hi, Pete. We flew by him. And I saw him at New Balance like a week later. Do you guys train like that all the time? No, we just had to get the train. It might have looked impressive, but no.
So, Paul, I'm also detecting outside of running a little bit of an arc that kind of seems to follow education, coaching. You've mentioned Jewish
community
center, and then the why. How does this all fit together? Can you give us a little sense as to, because it seems like a fairly integral part of who you are.
Yeah, so before, and even a little bit when I was running for New Balance, but when we had the Coastal Track Club, I got involved in helping organize races for charity. It would come to me, so I'd help. Okay. So I kind of got into that charitable, giving back a little bit, volunteering. So my contract was up in 1988. So that's when I was 32 years old. So I guess New Balance, I was old and slow, and I couldn't get another contract. So I had to get a real job, and which was, it was interesting to me because that, you know, depending on what they were looking for, that Thanksgiving, right before I had the conversation with them, I won the Jordan Marsh 5 mile race, and my picture was front page of the sports section, big above the fold. It was really big, New Balance all across. That's, you can't buy that type of stuff. So I was a little disappointed, but what it did do for me, so that was like a Saturday, I think, that race. That Saturday night was my 15th high school reunion, and everybody saw my picture. I had a really good reunion that night. Everybody knew what I did. And, so they saw my picture on the Globe. So that worked out well for me. But
the MTV ratings go down after once you got a job? That was the start of their downfall. It's too bad. I mean, we had like 4 or 5 more years out of you. Who knows? Who knows? But
so then.
That's good.
Figuring what I had to get a real job, and
as we all did. Yep.
At the reunion, a friend of mine said, "Oh, they're looking for a senior program director at the Jewish Community Center, and they've had some trouble finding someone in and out, and they want someone that can bring some attention as well." I wasn't Jewish, and I really didn't have a program background in it, but I understood, you know, fitness, and so I got interviewed, got the job, and was with them for about 4 years or so. But I knew I needed to do more. I went back to school to get my master's degree during that time. And we had our another child who, Ron, Mimi, was our nurse. Our daughter was born with multiple disabilities. And so that had an impact on me. And I went to a conference for the JCC up in Toronto, just outside. And there was this place called Variety Village, which looked like a big YMCA, but it worked with people with physical disabilities. So everything was universally designed. You know, they would have, you know, in hallways, they would have different textures for visually impaired, so they knew where they were, different flooring or bar with braille underneath, so they knew where they were, wheelchair. A track that, you know, was specifically built for wheelchair racers. They had a little hotel for athletes. I said, what a great idea. And I came back and I started a not-for-profit around this. And I brought in people that I knew, people in the medical world, legal, all my contacts. And long story short, I was able to raise $2 million in seed money. But I met the YMCA in that, because they were looking to do something at the Alston Brighton Y, the old Alston Brighton Y, to build something. And they thought this would be a good pilot around disability. So I helped write the white paper for that and met John Farrell, the CEO. And at that time, so that had been about 4 years I was working on it, and my daughter passed away. And I was looking, this isn't going exactly what I wanted. And I talked to John Farrell, and he said, well, I got some positions at the Y. We'd love to have you, and you can take some of your ideas and work. And that's how I met the Y. And I worked over it. My first one was over in Wakefield in 1996, Wakefield and Reading Y. And I met a gentleman, gave us $2 million, built a big brand new Y there, moved up here to Marblehead, built a big brand new Y, $15 million Y here. And that got me the job as CEO of the South Shore Y. And we've done about $50 million of projects, and just got into all things, and bringing what I've learned working with people, like my special education background, working with people with developmental disabilities and for physical disabilities as well. We get a partnership program. We have Spalding Rehab in our facilities. And so it all kind of tied in. And what running helped me was, all of you know, it's the discipline. It's the focus and the discipline. And you have to set daily goals, weekly goals, monthly goals, yearly goals, and you have a vision, exactly what you have to do in anything in not-for-profit or business. And no matter what happened, you know, when you ran, when you finish your run, you achieved the goal. Everything else is gravy for the rest of the day, really. You know, it's, but that discipline and focus, and as the people who work for me said, I say I'm stubborn. You know, they say, no, you're too hard. You're persistent. And, you know, so you just stay on it. You know, in fundraising, you work with so many different folks, billionaires, and it's relationship building. And it is a marathon. You just don't ask someone for $1 million. It's building a relationship and staying in touch and educating them and doing that over and over. So running really helped me during all that time.
I think that's one of the best translations of what had been back in the day to where we are today, Paul, that we've heard in the 3 years of doing this. I don't know. I see some nodding heads. It really is. And for the listeners who don't have the benefit, obviously, of the video, if you had seen, you've probably heard in Paul's voice, but if you saw physically how excited and how animated he got, that brings it up to an entirely different level. So thank you for that. I'm ready to run through a wall. I don't know about you guys, but this is pretty cool.
Definitely inspiring.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So anything that you want to make sure that we capture, because our time is growing short. We saw a tail just kind of gum through there.
Oh, yeah, Gunner. Yeah, that's Gunner.
Okay.
My kids want to come back as our dog because we treat him so much better than we do our kids. So,
yeah.
And that's our first dog. You know, it's the first dog we ever had. So he's been.
Okay. Oh, there you go.
But, you know, just, you know, I was just looking back and thinking of a couple of stories. And, you know, one story, you know, you run for New Balance, and sometimes they like to, New Balance in other parts of the world want runners to go, you know, sponsored runners to go. So there was this race down in Puerto Rico. It wasn't San Blas, but it was this race in Juncos. And they asked if me, and I can't remember who it was. He's from Pennsylvania, but he ran for New Balance too.
Spiny?
Yes. Yeah.
Don Roman. Yeah.
Yeah. So we went down together to Puerto Rico because we heard what a great time it was that they stayed in San Juan and then go for the race. So we fly down, we're all excited, and we get there in the evening, and anyone that's been south of the border, Puerto Rico, the clock means nothing. Time means nothing to them. So we're waiting at the airport, no one's there, it's dark, and all of a sudden, a couple of people come in the car, and, you know, we met up, and they're all excited for us. Oh, this is going to be great. We have a parade the night before. Great. So we get in the car, we drive, we keep driving. The lights of the city kind of are fading behind us. And we end up in these mountains. This year, they weren't keeping us in San Juan. It was in this little village, this little town, Juncos. We get there. So it's like 10 or 11 o'clock at night, dark. And they drive up to this health clinic. And we go up to the second floor of this health clinic. And these bunk beds all around. And a bunch of the runners are all there. This couple guys from Sweden, South America, and they're all kind of asleep. One of them had his own bodyguard. The guy had a gun holstered while he was sleeping right there. Oh my God, we'd look at each other. So we're dead tired. We slept. We wake up the next day, and somebody got bit by something that night. You know, it was all swollen and everything. We're looking. So we got to get out of here. So we made up some excuse that, you know, we want to be tourists too. We're going to get someplace in San Juan and, you know, do some sightseeing. And, but we came back for that night, and they have this big parade for the whole town. They had all the politicians there speaking all night. It went on for hours and hours, just speaking. You know, this big race, there's a half marathon the next day through the mountains of Puerto Rico in January at 90 degrees down there. You're coming from the winter. So we start out, they're lined up. There's a lot of the top runners from different places. And then a bunch of guys in Converse sneakers at the starting line too, ready to go for a half marathon. We were warned not to take any water on the race course. And as you're running the races, they're also cooking some type of meat that we weren't quite sure that they offered us when we were running. But so we're going, and I started to pull away with this guy from South America, Victor Mora, I think his name was. And I started to pull away. And so we're at the 10-mile mark at the top of the hills. So we're coming down the next 3 miles. Well, when you're coming downhill, it kind of starts to shake things inside of you. And all of a sudden, I could feel like, I don't know if I'm going to make it back. And he started to pull away. I'm squeezing my cheeks to get in there. And I just barely made it, finish line in. And I'm like, oh, what an experience for
running. Well, once a runner, always a runner. Yeah. And all of us have had those experiences on a run. I'm not so sure in a race.
Yeah.
But on that interesting note, I suspect it's time for us to call it a night. Paul Gorman, thank you so much for spinning some yarns, giving us a story of the non-traditional life of a runner in the great runner's boom, the runner's boom of the 70s through the 80s. You totally fit the bill. You totally fit the era. And it's been a real pleasure having you join us for this last hour. Thank you so much for joining us on season 3 of the Runner's Reunion Podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul.
Great to see you.
Thanks,
all.
Paul.
Yep. Thank you.